This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
2 hours of current affairs, and many thanks to Anne McAllister for her Celtic Folk Show. And at six, it's Done by Law, presented by lawyers from the community legal centres, not to be missed. But for the next 2 hours, you'll hear from Ahmed Alabad and Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Alahan talking about the Zionist influence in Australian politics and media, and this is part three. Dr. Colin Hughes from Western Australia, he's the IPAN Independent Peaceful Australia Network representative, and he's also a former head of public health in Western Australia, and he'll be talking about what IPAN is up to and an important petition for you to sign. Part one of the profile of Uruguay, a small, very small country near the bottom of South America, bordering on Brazil and Argentina. Professor Emeritus Stuart Rees talking about Antoinette Latouf and her victory over the ABC and the Zionist lobby here in Australia and what that means for other areas of Australia and the role of the media in supporting the Zionist lobby here in Australia and I'd imagine in a few other countries as well. Wayne Wadsworth, formerly of Melbourne, then Lismore, now in Iron Knob in South Australia, with his ideas about a world-wise eco-banking system. But first, let's hear it for Mr. Kevin Healy and his Week That Was.
And I suspect we'll say many times again how ignorant we are of the intricacies of the greatest little economic order of them all, and we must leave these things to the knowledgeable great practitioners. We, that's being presumptive, you may well have more comprehension than I, listener, but I must leave these things like this week, Tuesday headline welcoming the new financial year. ASX gains tip to stay. The Trubla Wazi share market has recorded its best financial year since the pandemic. Major investors are optimistic for the next year. Oh goody, I thought, goody goody, the economy's going really well. Then, very next day, report that poor salt, fat and sugar exponent McDonald's had lost a case in the Fair Work Trubla Wazi, no longer work choices, just looks like it commission. The commission ruling it must bargain wages and conditions under the socialist multi-employer agreement laws. Poor McDonald's, which has lavished the basic award conditions, the lowest possible, on its teenage workforce. Now, don't forget, best year, investors confident, yet our old mate, Trubla Wazi Industry Profits Group's the Primo Innes will cost the workers, slammed the decision as deeply disappointing because many small businesses are struggling to survive in the current difficult trading environment. But hang on, best year, investors confident, difficult trading environment. Poor struggling to survive McDonald's. Any wonder we have to leave our comprehension to great minds like Innes. The decision, Innes staged, vindicates long-standing caring employer concerns about the scope of the multi-employer bargaining measures. The decision, he warned, highlights the risk for thousands of employers. If only those young wage slaves, lucky enough to have a job young people, would be satisfied that McDonald's, their caring employer, is prepared, indeed happy, to pay them the basic award wages and conditions. Worse, Innes informed us, the majority of employees were not even consulted before this irresponsible grab for higher wages and conditions. Dear, dear. I wonder how many were consulted when McDonald's imposed the conditions on them, their non-conditions. Some consolation for poor struggling to survive McDonald's, and Innes for that matter, is it would not be struggling to survive as much as the punters who eat its rubbish. But at least as their health declines, they'll have that epitome of care and concern, the private health industry, to see them through their last days. After health insurance rose 18% yet again recently, Boo Poo has found an even smarter way to save shareholder earnings. Match the 18% increase with rejecting claims by the punters silly enough to pay it, for which it was fined $35 million. How unfair. Penalised for a profitable business tactic. Plus, it has to reimburse the punters it chose not to help. And don't expect to see or hear this item on the Channel Stacks of Wealth 7 News, but Channel Stacks of Wealth has been sprung, underpaying journalists for years, tens of thousands owed, but let's make it clear, inadvertently. As we've noted, and thank goodness it's just a miracle that, these great corporate citizens never overpay staff inadvertently. These great corporate citizens display their concern for all of us, for the common good, by coming up with all sorts of ways the public purse should be spent on them. Nearstar, for instance, which smelts critical minerals but is losing heaps, yet with the national interest at heart, says the government must bail it out so Trubler-Wozzeck can keep smelting critical minerals, joining a long list of mineral companies trying to help the economy by raiding the public purse. So let's hope big economic guru Jim Chalmers' Capital and the socialists ignore these economic iconoclasts, former heads of the Productivity Workers Must Work Harder con mission, who therefore should know better, who warned Jim the government could be throwing good money after bad. As if responsible corporates would let the government do that. Why, they're always advising government on how not to waste money. So the government should leap at the generous offer when the private sector, which knows the government keeping out of the economy is good for all of us, offers the government a chance to participate in the private sector, like fund it. Sometimes we have to wonder why some things are considered news, like this item this week regarding our minister for being offensive and train-killing Richard Malls the Bad Guys. Headline, military chiefs kept Malls the Bad Guys in the dark. Well, that's hardly a major challenge. What's news in that? Richard seeing the minutest, slightest ray of light would be news. Speaking of slight, Richard would also be ashamed that so many Trubler-Wozzies could so hurt his being offensive and train-killing hero, US of the UN, of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor. Richard, who proudly boasts Trubler-Wozzie's independence, we independently do whatever the US of orders us to do, ashamed that a survey showed that most Trubler-Wozzies think Donald is, sit down, listen, to think the great leader of the free world, of liberty, freedom and democracy, therefore our spiritual leader is, I can hardly say it, dumb, dishonest and dangerous. Donald, dumb, dishonest and dangerous. At least it's alliterative. What, apart from Donald's words and actions, would lead people to think that? He's not qualified to hold his job, they say. Well, we've got news for them. 3.5 years of dumb, dishonest and dangerous, not qualified, where he'll attempt to concoct a crisis, forcing him to tear up the Constitution, at which he has daily practice, and run again. 4 more years to make America great again by reverse Robin Hood, rob the poor to pay the rich. Even more exciting, not just the US old poor, but the poorest of the poor across the globe. Yet less exciting, indeed extremely sad, is the brilliant exchange of highly intelligent invectives between former very, 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 brackets temporary, close friends, Donald and Elon. Isn't it upsetting when thieves fall out? Donald's balanced and appropriate invective was rightfully aimed at that parvenu Islamic 33-year-old Democratic socialist who knocked off Andrew Cuomo for the New York mayoral Democratic nomination, a dangerous Democratic socialist against a respectable, very much not Democratic nor socialist sex offender, who'll be up against the sitting mayor, Eric Adams, another respectable non-democratic non-socialist who was facing a corruption indictment until Donald arbitrarily dismissed it, saving Eric the problem of having to prove his innocence, like the thousands and thousands Donald has locked up in penitentiaries across the US of, including in the Florida Everglades, where Donald cracks some very, very funny jokes about alligators and snakes, who also, the locked up, not the alligators and snakes, who also will have no chance to prove their innocence because in their case, Donald knows they are not innocent. Indeed, his very bright national security person told us these locked up and being increasingly locked up immigrants are the most evil people in the world. No exceptions, all of them. The most evil people in the world. Proving this Zoran Mamdani, he's the dangerous democratic socialist. Well, with a name like that and being a Muslim, must be one of the most evil people in the world. And his policies attest to that. He wants to raise the corporate tax rate to all of 11.5%. But how's this for socialism run riot? A surcharge on those earning more than a million. All to pay for free bus services and universal childcare. He is out of control. Any wonder in his thoughtful, carefully considered and balanced way, Donald was forced to call him a 100% communist lunatic, a radical lefty, a 100% communist lunatic, radical lefty, most ever, ever. If that's not enough proof, the most admired and respected are also distressed. Story this week opened, panicked Wall Street financiers are racing to rally behind an anyone but Mamdani candidate. What more proof do we need? Owen Donald, whose natural restraint prevents him from saying a bad word about anyone, was forced to criticise an evil Iranian leader this week for being disrespectful and rude. No comment. We suspect Donald will soon have to level a few restrained, balanced criticisms at the Europa Nostra Foundation, clearly another 100% commie, long-haired, greedy lot who oppose a huge real estate project, a real estate opportunity by Donald's son-in-law Jared Kushner in Belgrade. Europa Nostra, the peak body of more than 200 European heritage protection bodies, carrying on just because it involves demolishing a huge heritage site which had protected heritage, had because Donald's very, very, very close friend, brackets temporary, all Donald's friends are temporary, Serbian Supremo Alexander Vecic lifted the heritage protection to assist Jared. And okay, an official has been charged with falsifying signatures on the rescission document, but it's legal, thanks to Alexander and the official and Jared. So Donald will understandably have to get very upset with this Europa Nostra disruptive lot if they insist on fighting what is now the law. Jared, of course, alerted Donald to the real estate opportunity, the Riviera opportunity in Gaza, as long as they get rid of the non-land, non-people, with, in this case, another Donald from friend Benjamin Not Another Yahoo doing all he can to do just that. With this week, Donald and Benjamin's humanitarian soup kitchen calling out for donations of food. Oh, so you can feed more of the starving non-land, non-people. Feed them? No. So we can kill more of them. Yes, that's the humanitarian choice. Starve or be shot. Like our state socialists, as the Westgate Tunnel Project costs soar again, a proposal thrown up by Road Behemoth transferring your money to increase its profits. So obviously any cost blowouts must be borne by transferred and the construction companies, except the government signed a contract that transferring can trigger a, quote, linked claim against the public purse when costs do blow out. These companies must laugh all the way to the bank when they deal with government, mustn't they? Finally, the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin found the best possible way to lead into NAIDOC Week. Attack the state socialists for establishing a terra nullius non-land, non-people voice to Parliament. After, as Lord Rupert points out, Nay screams out, the people rejected a voice. As Lord Rupert turned into a hero, a council worker who objected to a welcome to country in his workplace. Political correctness out of control. Real political correctness. Not the ratbag, commie, greedy, woke political correctness. Real political correctness is to ensure the terra nullius non-land, non-people retain their social status as non-land, non-people. After all, how can we hear the voice of people who don't exist? Good afternoon.
And many thanks to Mr. Kevin Healy for his week that was. And tomorrow morning, at 9 o'clock sharp, Mr. Kevin Healy and friends with City Limits.
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favourite radio program is produced? On Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2025. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR, Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July. See you then.
We continue now with the conversation between Palestinian activist Ahmed Alabadla and journalist Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aharanam.
Today's conversation is titled Promoting Israel in Australia, the Influence of the Israel Lobby on Australian Politics and Media. Again, I am delighted today to be in conversation with Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aharon. Wendy Bacon is an independent investigative journalist and lifelong radical activist. She has investigated miscarriages of justice, deaths in custody, News Corp's coverage of climate change, urban developments, police corruption, and most recently, astroturfing in the 2025 federal election. Yaakov Aharon is new to journalism. Having come from a background of activism, Yaakov brings unique perspectives to the Palestinian struggle, credited to his political journey away from the ultra-orthodox Jewish and pro-Israel education of his youth. His research concerns the Israel lobby, Jewish community, party politics, and the arms trade. Now, in session one, we held a live conversation with the audience, and given the popularity of the topic, we were not able to address all the questions that we had planned to answer, and then we also were faced with a barrage of questions from attendees that we couldn't address all of them. So today we'll attempt to answer many of those questions that we identified as really, really important to the topic. I want to start with the first question relating to the Israel lobby's influence in election, federal election, and in party politics in general. I'll probably start with you, Wendy, and then Yaakov, you can add to it. In terms of influence in the Labour Party, is that mainly from Zionists within the party, pressure from outside groups, or both? And how is this influence exerted as well? Can this influence be interrupted?
It's a pretty broad question. And so I think we're talking about the 2025 election, the recent election. As far as the Labour Party goes, there's just been a strong and long persistent pressure within the Labour Party to keep it within the, if you like, pro-Israel camp. And that pressure goes right back to the 1970s, but particularly in the 1980s. So we're talking about like 45 years now of strong activity when Mark Liebler was a student politician at Melbourne University. He was already very prominent in Zionist organisations in Melbourne, also representing beginning to get involved with corporations that were connected with Israel. And then we had the sort of Hawke years and then the Gillard years, and they were very much in that pro-Israel world. As well as that, of course, we've had the Labour Friends of Palestine, and they are a distinct group within the Labour Party. And they've also, there's always been people inside the Labour Party who are much more pro-Palestinian, particularly people, of course, from Lebanese and Palestinian backgrounds, but not only them, just, you know, radicals who've, you know, grew up in the 1960s, particularly with perspectives that were pro-Palestinian and from then on as well. Look, I think it'd be quite, it'd take quite a bit of time to talk about how effective the Labour Friends of Palestine are. But I mean, they can move at a grassroots level and they do get motions passed. However, because of the way our party system works now, with power concentrated at the top in the parliamentary party, looks promising, but then it can take a big step backwards. Just shifting then to the groups outside the Labor Party, there's various astroturfing groups in the last election, and we'll maybe come to them, but I think it's very significant here to mention Better Australia. Now, I suggest, because there's so little coverage in our mainstream media of these third party groups or astroturfing, in a way they operate at one level, claiming they're on about one thing, but in fact, in the case of Better Australia and others of the groups in the last election, they're just very pro-Zionist, very much about Zionism, but they claim to be about something broader. So if we just take Better Australia, set up last year initially, they are a bipartisan group. They are both explicitly bipartisan, both Labor and Liberal. The Labor Party is, like, the key person in Better Australia was a woman called Sophie Callan, not by any means necessarily the most influential person, or the most, but she was out there as the face of it. And I just wanted to say it's sort of very interesting, because really there is no doubt about that. And they spent a lot of money. You can look on their own Instagram and you can see all the things they did. It wasn't just in mail outs, it wasn't just at the election booths. There were trucks and billboards on them. There was, they've spent a lot of money, quite a lot of money anyway. When we published, when Yakov and I published our articles, I thought there would be more reaction. It had already been published that Sophie Callan was a member of the Labor Party. But when I was out interviewing people on the booths and just talking to other people I knew connected with the Labor Party, and no one wanted to talk about it. I did have one person who was a grassroots member of the Labor Party who was giving me a very hard time on social media, claiming I'm an unethical journalist and it's all wrong. But apart from that, there's other people, like, for example, the member of Sydney, Tanya Plibersek, who I sent questions to, who got those questions, who knows very well what it's all about. But, absolutely no response. I did hear that from within the Labor Party, that even though, in a sense, what the Labor members were doing inside Better Australia were campaigning with the Liberal Party campaigners for a major party win. Now, it didn't matter whether it was Labor or Liberal, so long as it was a major party, and it was all attacks on the Greens and the Teals. Even though you would think that would be in breach of Labor Party rules and certainly potentially bring the party into bad repute, which is one of the rules, there was no complaints laid, nothing happened. And I think that goes to the powerlessness which the Labor Friends of Palestine feel in relation to the hierarchy. The Labor Friends of Israel, which was formed last year, but in a sense is a reflection of forces already operating within the Labor Party. One of the patrons of that is Nova Peres, and maybe we'll come back to Nova Peres, the ex-Labor senator. Very, very active player in Better Australia. Perhaps no one put us, in terms of well-known people, put herself out there with Better Australia in the way that Nova Peres did. Well, she's currently in Israel with a group of indigenous people that she has recruited. She's in Israel and posting from Israel. And she only posts about what is happening for Israelis. There is nothing about what is happening for Gazans or people on the West Bank. And also, some of her social media posts are definitely Islamophobic. Now, she is the patron of the Labor Friends of Israel. So that poses a really big question, I think, for the people who claim to be in the Labor Party who are pro-Palestinian. They would say they're doing their best, but maybe I should draw that to a close. But
Paris, she also stirring a lot of controversy and conversations within the First Nations community as well.
Absolutely. Yes, Amy Maguire, who's a scholar and a very respected Indigenous person in Queensland, who's also a very good journalist herself. She's published an article today absolutely repudiating Nova Peris's claim that in any sense to be acting for the First Nations communities in Australia. I mean, she's out on a limb, but she's on a limb where News Corp gives her, like, she's there with a News Corp journalist, she's there with Paige Taylor from The Australian. So, and again, you see this overlap between the political activity, the parties, the media, the paid for trips to Israel. Things operate in a fairly connected, if you like, networking sort of way, rather than either this is the Labor Party, this is her as a Indigenous person. Does that make that clear?
I'm keen to get your thoughts on that, Yaakov, on that question about the involvement of the Israel lobby in the Labour Party. But I do have another question about the Labour Party, maybe for later on in particular. But what are your thoughts on this question, Yaakov?
It needs to actually go a bit further back in history than that. I mean, the Labour Party was founded literally on two policies on day one, which was one, connection to the unions, of course. Two, this is the part people forget, the brown people are taking union jobs and undercutting white working class by going for a lower rate. White Australia was really crucial to the Labour Party in the very beginning. Come 1948, it was actually Labour that really pushed for voting in the UN to recognise Israel. And in fact, they had the support. The real people pushing Labour successfully to take that position was the Communist Party of Australia. If you fast forward to the 60s, the Labour Party was really gung-ho on cracking down on dissent to the Vietnam War. It changed a little bit with Whitlam. We saw how that turned out for him, not very well. When you go a bit more forward to the current day, I mean, the Labour Party actually has very authoritarian measures in the way that they run their own party room behind closed doors. If you're a cabinet member, you need to treat every single cabinet policy as if it is your own. You are not allowed to criticize it. Otherwise, pretty much procedurally, you have to step down the next day. You're not allowed to cross the floor, even as a normal Labour member or Labour senator. Otherwise, almost always, you are booted from the party. The Liberal Party, which is usually a bit more authoritarian than Labour in the way that it governs Australia as a country, is actually less authoritarian the way it governs its party room. There is opportunity to cross the floor if you're a Liberal politician. You can vote for Labour policies. You can speak up against cabinet positions. And so when Israel gets the full support of the Labour Party, then every single cabinet position is hanging their career on that support.
Everything that Yakov has said, I agree with historically. And I agree that Labour from the 1940s onwards supported Israel. But there was a lot of pressure in the Labour Party in the 1960s. Like, even though, for example, originally Labour did support the Australian troops being in Vietnam, but huge pressure movement was growing back then in relation to the Vietnam War. So actually in Melbourne, where the biggest moratorium march was, that was led by Jim Cairns, who was then a senior figure and became Labor treasurer in the Whitlam government. What happened is that sort of group, it would call it sort of pro-Israel group that Yaakov was referring to, that began to slip and was contested. And some of the Labor Friends of Palestine reflect that group that was putting pressure on then. And I think that's when, I found once an article from the 1970s which said, because Whitlam, before he was deposed, was showing some signs of becoming more pro-Palestinian under pressure from people within the Labor Party and within the unions, of course. That's when the Zionist lobby got more organised, particularly in Melbourne. You know, there was a contest. I think that's what we're saying. There has been a contest inside the Labor Party, but those pro-Israel forces have ultimately triumphed at the moment. And you have people who, you know, for example, there's an MLC, that, you know, member of the Legislative Council in New South Wales, Stephen Lawrence, who has asked excellent questions at an inquiry into anti-Semitism at the moment, quite significant questions. But his power outside that sphere and his capacity to vote against, say, anti-protest bill by Minns, who is extremely pro-Zionist and pro-Israel, is, as Yaakov has explained, is sort of, in relation to that, if he wants to be in there, he's powerless. He can still try within that sphere, operate according to his values and politics, I guess. You know, there's just that contradiction.
I'm actually surprised to learn that the Labour Friends of Israel have just recently formed. So the recent pressure that the Labour were under by the Israel lobby organisations, I think it still existed, but it wasn't formalised in that manner. But to that question, I do want to ask this question about Mark Dreyfus's function or role in pushing that Israel lobby narrative. And also, if you could address that bit about the Ed Husic's role in combating that, if there was any role in there.
Just in relation to Ed Husic, I think he's a classic case that you can see that when he was in cabinet, we heard maybe a tiny bit, but very little, very little. You would think that he would have felt compelled then to speak up more on behalf of his community and behalf of people in his electorate. But because of that.
And we saw that with Bob Carr and previous politicians. It's just
exactly.
Whenever they are in cabinet.
And so that is the price they're prepared to pay is. And in order to pursue their political, I guess, preferences. One could be more cynical in terms of careers, but nevertheless, it's no doubt that Husic, having been put out of cabinet, is probably both very annoyed, but also probably now is actually talking about things that he does believe in. So he's using... Now, you could compare that to Senator Payman, who actually reached a point that she couldn't go any further. Her values, as I meant, she had to step outside it. So, you know, these are the individual trajectories of people move along and many, let's say 95, 99% compromise in order to pursue their Labour Party careers. Now, Dreyfus and Yaakov might like definitely to say more about this. Dreyfus obviously brought up a Zionist and a member of the Labour Party in Melbourne, which absolutely would have been, you know, the milieu he moved in, and he's a senior person, senior lawyer in Melbourne. So, you know, he gets to be a senior person, fairly senior person in the Labour Party. Now, one thing that I have noted in doing research into a committee that's called Security and Intelligence Committee, it's a very powerful and important committee in Parliament. It's a joint committee, which means it's across both houses. It is never allowed, except for once when Andrew Wilkie was on it very briefly, they've never allowed anybody but major party people onto that committee. Like most committees, you get one of the independents or you get one Green, but they've never allowed anybody onto that committee because it's sort of like in-house security, if you like. And so they've passed, you know, they support a lot of the extreme, very anti-civil liberties, terrorist provisions, anti-terrorist provisions. Over the years, they've played a very poor role as far as civil liberties go. In the last stage of the Morrison government, there were moves that were definitely pushed forward by the Zionist organisations, Zionist Federation of Australia and AJAC and others, to get Hamas and Hezbollah up to this time had only been partially listed as banned organisations. And that was for the very good reasons, as even ASIO and Foreign Affairs could explain, is that for a lot of families in Australia, they had connections with those organisations that played welfare roles. And I mean, you might, I don't know if you'd want to add something here yourself, but, you know, they were part of the fabric for many families of their lives. So that was always a consideration, which is why only the military wings were banned in Australia. You know, again, some people might also have things to say about that, but that was the case. Suddenly, they wanted to get these organisations completely banned. And Dreyfus, he was a member of the opposition then, but he just completely went along with that, didn't ask one any critical questions. Aunt Ali, who was the other Labor Party politician, you might have expected something better maybe, but no, you know, no effective oppositions. It was just stitched up. And then very quietly, they slipped those organisations in with the hate symbols legislation. And that's how we got to the extraordinary situation last year where at the protest after Hezbollah, after Nasrallah had been assassinated, people arrived thinking they could fly a flag, and suddenly it was all illegal, it was all the worst thing they could do. And I saw women crying about that. Like, really, when I say women crying, maybe men were too, but women sort of weeping, and they sort of, I think, felt humiliated as much as anything else. So I go back to Dreyfus and just say he's played his role in that way. Now, in terms of his support for Israel, of course, nothing is ever enough. You know, people from the pro-Palestinian movement would look at Labour and say they've, and especially this week, I think also back with the, you know, Israel's right to defend itself when it's sending, you know, bombing raids over Iran sounds ridiculous. But, you know, it's never enough. And so you've got from the right-wing Zionists or the hardcore Zionists, you got attacks on Dreyfus to the point that he was being booed at an anti-Semitism summit run by News Corp. So he sort of ended up in a really tricky position, I think. He seems to have gone out and campaigned for the election and done quite well in his seat, but and then he ended up out of cabinet as well.
Yeah, and even his statements around anti-Semitism always confusing criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic
yes,
as well. I'm keen to get Yaakov's point before we move into the next question, because we cannot spend too much time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he explicitly said that a lot of people, when they criticize Zionists, and they really go out of their way to use the word Zionist, that they in fact mean Jews. It's not even a conflation. He has merged the two, and he has said that no matter how careful you are with your rhetoric, where you direct your criticism, it is still anti-Semitic. You know, it really tells you just the mentality of the Israel lobby that this guy's still not good enough for them. They still consider him bad news. And you saw a Jewish presenter on Sky News, I believe it was Caroline Marcus, could be wrong, who said that he was a capo in a scripted segment. She was reading off a teleprompter, did a whole segment on why he is a capo, gave the definition of a capo, the history of a capo, and why Mark Dreyfus fits into that. And I mean, what is really interesting with this Sky News anti-Semitism summit that Wendy mentioned is that actually Chris Minns also stood up to the podium and gave a speech, and he was applauded the whole way through. The Israel lobby really loves the New South Wales Labor government, but has directed a lot of vitriol at the federal government. We saw the same thing with Josh Burns and McNamara. A lot of it is that, you know, these are different governments who aren't always on the same page, even though that they are both the Labor Party. Minns in New South Wales has an easy way out because it actually isn't his job to manage foreign affairs for the most part as a state government. So he doesn't need to take a clear position, and he can actually play right into the Israel lobby's game, which is always to never talk about what's happening in Israel or Palestine and always make it a domestic issue of anti-Semites have gotten a green light to run rampant on Australian streets. And that is always the distraction that they're trying to make. With Dreyfus, he became a real lightning rod for the Israel lobby's anger, as did Josh Burns. But what was interesting is that in Josh Burns' electorate in McNamara, we can actually see from the data about how different polling booths performed and voted for him. He was an underdog to win that election in his seat. He still got through in a very tight three-way race. And we saw that actually performed pretty well in the polling booths that have mostly Jewish populations. There was a really well-funded campaign from fake grassroots groups, which many hundreds of thousands of dollars injected into them by Liberal Party aligned think tanks, by fossil fuel companies, by the Israel lobby too, to paint Josh Burns as an anti-Semite. It just didn't catch on with the actual grassroots of the community.
You've been listening to a conversation between Palestinian activist Ahmed Alabadla and journalists Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aharan, talking about influence of the Zionist lobby in Australian politics and the media. More next week.
The war on Palestine has not stopped. Palestinians need self-determination. Gaza must be free of Israeli occupation forces, have unconditional access to aid and reconstruction. 17 years of Israeli siege must end.
The West Bank needs the violence and attacks by the Israeli army and settlers to stop, and an end to the occupation and apartheid.
Your support to end the war on Gaza, to bring peace, justice and freedom to all of Palestine, is needed more than ever.
Converge on Canberra, 20th to the 22nd of July. Sanction Israel. Join the united call to sanction the state of Israel in response to the genocide on Palestine.
With Netanyahu and Trump threatening to ethnically cleanse Gaza and annex the West Bank, we all need to stand up and say no.
Converge on Canberra, 20th to the 22nd of July. Sanction Israel.
With your support, Palestine will be free, from the river to the sea.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
VCR, your station, your voice.
These weapons are pointed at all of us. Take it personally.
And we need to be standing with communities on the front lines and really amplifying their fight and their voices.
And fight this until Australia is no longer one of the leading weapons manufacturers.
3CR, your station, your voice.
And continuing my conversation with Dr. Colin Hughes, the representative for IPAN in Western Australia. And this brings me to the IPAN, Independent Peaceful Australia Network, support for a solidarity campaign with peoples of the Pacific. Can you explain that?
Yes. The people of the Pacific are saying that we've got to go away from this military response to security. They know that their major security threat is climate change. The people of Tuvalu have already been granted visas to come to Australia. I have been to the islands in the Torres Strait as a flying doctor. And the problem is that the sea level rises are affecting the groundwater. They used to have wells because the water actually comes from New Guinea. It goes deep under the ocean and comes up in springs in these volcanic islands that exist throughout the Pacific. We're not talking about the coral islands. We're talking about the volcanic ones. And deep down in that was fresh water. But as the sea level rises, that becomes brackish, and so that now they've got no fresh water. On top of that, a 10 or 15 centimetre rise in water may not sound very much, but when you bring 1,000 kilometres of water across the Pacific, pushed by a gale force wind of a tornado or a cyclone, we're now looking at sea level rises of 4 and 5 metres, which will completely wipe out these low-lying islands. So, you know, this is what they're concerned about. So they are saying very clearly, please stop spending money on arms. We want to become a non-aligned, neutral area. We are not going to be aligned to China, which means we will not allow China to have any military bases in the South Pacific. We will not allow America to have any nuclear base or any military bases in the South Pacific. And Australia should do exactly the same thing. We should join with these people saying that we need a non-aligned armed neutrality. Yes, Australia can have its own ring of drones and short-range IBMs if China was ever able to get past the over 100 US bases that surround China, that's just so ludicrous to even think. But it is possible to protect Australia with the echidna strategy. So, yes, we need a non-aligned Pacific neutrality. And it is very reassuring that the Australian federal government has met with IPAN and other peace groups, and have now got an extra $15 million to fund the development of regional peaceful cooperation and conflict resolution in the South Pacific. So this Australian government, they're not talking about it. They're not talking about it out loud. But it is happening, you know, this quiet diplomacy behind the scenes. And Albanese, to give him his due, has resisted all of the requests to increase defence spending to 5% that what America wants. He's quite clearly saying, we will decide how much or what we need, and then we will decide how we're going to pay for it. And what they need, of course, is not just weapons, but they do need this soft diplomacy, mutual recognition of each other's needs in terms of education, cultural exchange, even sport. I mean, I have no problem in them funding the NRL team from Papua New Guinea. That will do more for soft diplomacy than parking any nuclear frigate in a harbour in Papua New Guinea.
And perhaps Albanese needs to pull Richard Miles back a peg or two.
Yes, the discipline in the Labor Party is absolutely wonderful. I mean, there is only one person who's speaking out, and that's Ed Husic. He has now, of course, been sacked from the ministry and is free as a backbencher to speak his mind on Gaza and other factors. But cabinet solidarity is extremely strong. There probably will be a cabinet reshuffle. You know, the crossbench is calling for this complete independent review of AUKUS. IPAN itself has got a webinar happening on the 13th of July, which your listeners may like to tune into by registering with IPAN. And what we are saying, led by people like Doug Cameron and Brigadier Ian Smith, ex-Brigadier, is saying we don't need AUKUS. We can cancel AUKUS. We can withdraw from the Force Posture Agreement and develop a truly independent Australian foreign policy and military policy in Australia, which will save lives, allow us to remain nuclear free, and still allow us enough money to look after the social needs of Australians to prevent any further inequality and social disruption that's going to occur if, like Europe, we start spending 5% on the military.
Well, when you take into account how much money has been spent on AUKUS and how much money they're planning on spending in the future, that brings our defence, so-called defence budget, way up.
Yes, it does. But unfortunately, it puts all the eggs into one basket, which are these silly nuclear submarines. Now, I don't think people are aware of AUKUS Stage 2. AUKUS Stage 2 is about cyber security. It's about the highly technical development of drones and missile guidance systems and so on. There's a huge amount of research and development. Australia thinks that it can participate in this because we actually have very clever people. We've got very good universities and they are funded by the military. So there is a lot of research and development potential in Australia. To a certain extent, this is what Europe is also saying, although I heard the comment by a commentator in Europe just on the weekend. Yes, they've agreed to 5%, but you will see the most creative accounting over the next 5 years to pretend that they're spending money on defence by building a bigger bridge so that it can support a tank going over it. In other words, they'll be using the money for just ordinary infrastructure and things like that in Europe until Trump can disappear, either by ill health — he's certainly showing all the signs of dementia — or whether he'll be thrown out after the next election. Yes, AUKUS stage two, there's a lot of fear involved in that as well.
Now, there is a petition for solidarity.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, I haven't got right in front of me the address for that. Maybe you can give it to our listeners in a minute or two. But it's really important. I mean, petitions do make a difference, because armed with a petition, or even the result of that petition, you are able to contact your local member and you say, are you aware that there are now 15,000 signatures calling for an independent review of AUKUS? And so it gives you a reason to write a letter to your local member of parliament or your local newspaper. Petitions are ignored by parliament. We know that Kevin Rudd got over 500,000 signatures calling for a royal commission into media ownership in Australia, and it was ignored by the Labor government. Can you believe that? So this was a proper parliamentary commission. But petitions do have a place in a democracy, and I urge your listeners and our listeners to, if they see it coming through their social media, click on the button, sign your name, but also have a look at the result of that and write your letter to your local community newspaper as well as the Daily. Ring up your talkback program and particularly talk to your local Member of Parliament.
I thank you for today, Colin.
And I look forward to our next discussion.
And from Perth in Western Australia, Dr. Colin Hughes, the Western Australian representative for IPAN, Independent Peaceful Australia Network. And to sign that petition, the address is ipan.org.au.
Tune in to the Beyond the Bars Prison broadcast during NAIDOC Week 2025. Listen to 3CR each weekday at 11 a.m. from Monday the 7th through to Friday the 11th of July. We'll be taking you inside six Victorian prisons: Dame Philip Frost Centre, Barwon Prison, Fulham Correctional Centre, Middleton Prison, Marguerite Correctional Centre and Port Phillip Prison. We'll be connecting with culture and community. There'll be stories, songs, opinions and poems from the men and women inside. The shows will be live on 3CR 855 on your AM dial, 3CR digital and streaming via our website, or on the Community Radio Plus app. Head to the website 3cr.org.au/beyondthebars2025 for more information.
Our country profile this month with Sasha Gillies-Lakakis is Uruguay, small country bordering Brazil, Argentina in South America. So, Sasha, as usual, we have a starting point for this very small country right down the bottom of South America.
Very interesting little country. It's nestled between Brazil and Argentina on the eastern side of South America, the southern cone still, so those southern nations at the bottom of the continent. It's a country that often gets overlooked because it's so small, but it has a very, very interesting history. It's been a hotbed for a lot of very radical ideas, and it's demonstrated very clearly, I think, the extremes of, on the one hand, you know, that sort of rapacious colonial an imperial history, which of course we'll get to. And then on the other hand, in more recent history, there's been some very, very noble and progressive changes in Uruguay, which is good to see. But of course, we always begin with the indigenous cultures of any country in Latin America. Uruguay as a concept doesn't exist until the 1830s. So we don't know this part of the world as Uruguay at the time. Of course, a number of different indigenous civilizations use that land that is today Uruguay. And a lot of the time they're coming either down from Brazil or down the Rio Paraguay, down from Paraguay along the river into what is now Uruguay, or up from Argentina. So it's a big melting pot, this area of Uruguay. It has very, very fertile grasslands. Most of Uruguay is flat land, which is why it becomes so lucrative as a cattle and meat exporting destination later on. But at the time, it's a very, very prized territory for nomadic and semi-nomadic indigenous peoples. So some of these cultures include the Catalanense and the Quarem, which came down from Brazil. And they, of course, also inhabit southern Brazil. And they were there from about 10,000 years ago. So very, very early indigenous civilization. And a little bit later, we have the Charrua and the Chana and the Guarani. Now, we've spoken a lot about the Guarani, who originated from Paraguay, from Argentina and Brazil. But there's also the Charrua and the Chana, who came about 6,000 to 7,000 years ago. So again, you know, very early civilizations. And these are overwhelmingly nomadic, semi-nomadic hunter-gatherer cultures who didn't have large settlements per se, like the Incas or the Aztecs, but certainly, you know, knew how to work the land and regularly settled in Uruguay for certain parts of the year to hunt for game, to grow small patches of vegetables. Generally, this was quite a peaceful part of Latin America in the pre-Columbian era. But of course, that ends up changing quite quickly once the Spanish arrive, very sadly. And because a lot of these cultures, these civilizations, are not particularly warlike either. They learn to become warlike, unfortunately, because of the Spanish incursions, but these are not warrior cultures by and large, particularly the Charrua and the Chana, who are probably Uruguay's most well-known indigenous people. They were largely peaceful, and they ended up having to take up arms later, but very, very sadly were genocided by the 1820s, 1830s. But of course, we have the Spanish first arriving in 1516, so a little bit later than the very first Spanish incursions into Latin America. And this was done by Juan Díaz de Solís, and this was the same conquistador who went up the Rio Paraguay to discover what is now Paraguay. Now, of course, his first entry point was actually the river mouth, which opens out into Uruguay's coastal territory. So this is de Solís' first incursion into the heart of South America. This is how he gets down into Paraguay and Bolivia and parts of Brazil. This is done through what it was called back then by the Spanish as La Banda Oriental. This is the name that Uruguay is known by up until the 1830s. And Banda Oriental means eastern band or eastern bend of the river, of the Rio Uruguay, which is another tributary. It's a tributary of both the Rio Paraguay and also the Rio de la Plata, which is the big river that empties out into Buenos Aires' bay, and the Amazon River, if you trace it back upstream far enough. So Banda Oriental is that little bit of territory that is now Uruguay. It was very, very sparsely populated by the Europeans. There wasn't anything in the way of resources. I mean, as we mentioned, even the indigenous people, you know, they used it because of its flat, very fertile land to go and hunt game. But it wasn't particularly suitable for sugar. Of course, Uruguay generally doesn't have a tropical climate. No big mineral reserves to speak of, even to this day. So the Spanish really sort of ignored it for quite a long time. And in fact, the only time we saw more interest after that initial 1516 visit, that expedition by Juan Díaz de Solís, was in 1624, so over a century later, where the Jesuits attempted to set up series of misiones, the missions, you know, to convert and Catholicize the Charrua and the Chana, those two indigenous cultures, which had by this time started fighting not only Spanish expeditions, but also Portuguese expeditions who were coming in from the south of Brazil. This is an important thing to remember, that Uruguay's history has often been tied to its larger neighbors, Argentina to the south, and of course, Brazil to the north, and, you know, often with very disastrous consequences for Uruguay's people. So we begin to see, you know, the beginnings of these sorts of skirmishes, but by and large, there isn't the huge genocide of indigenous people yet, simply because the Spanish haven't settled Uruguay yet. There isn't an actual proper European settlement in La Banda Oriental at this point. Now, they do end up establishing San Felipe de Montevideo, which is now the capital, Montevideo, in 1726. and this is on the northern banks of the Rio Uruguay. And if you look at a map, it almost directly sits opposite Buenos Aires. So this was created as another commercial port to sort of streamline the passage of commerce through all of these different rivers and tributaries, and even to send some of these goods up into Brazil, which was an expanding market at the time. So Montevideo was almost in competition with Buenos Aires, but it never superseded Buenos Aires because La Banda Oriental was still, politically speaking, a department of the Viceroy of Rio de la Plata. So that big Spanish territory of Argentina, Chile, Paraguay also included Uruguay. So it was subservient to the interests of Buenos Aires at the time. We begin to see really by about the 1720s, 1730s, we see the way the society is crystallizing. It's still a very, very sparsely populated region, about 30,000 people in total. And a third of these are African slaves. And this is something that consecutive Uruguayan governments throughout the 1800s and the early 20th century attempted to sort of stamp out with some very, very insidious migration policies to attempt to essentially, quote unquote, breed out African people in Uruguay. And to this day, Uruguay is one of the, quote unquote, whitest European South American countries. But at this early stage, about a third of those 30,000 people were African slaves taken over to begin to work in these farms that were being established by the Spanish elite. Horses were introduced and cattle and sheep were introduced in about the 1650s to Uruguay. And this is when we began to see a bit more interest because they saw how fertile the land was. And it was very, very good for rearing livestock. And there was money to be made, of course, in livestock, particularly cattle and sheep, which were good for export, and horses for war, for labor, and all of these sorts of other day-to-day uses. This is why we saw 50, 60 years later, Montevideo was founded in the early 1700s. We begin to see the import of African slaves. The indigenous population is also enslaved, but a lot of them are sort of left to their own devices, or they cross the border into the more poorly defended, you know, Brazilian interior, or even up the Rio Paraguay. And we don't actually see a full genocide of the indigenous people in Uruguay until the actual independence of the country in the 1820s, but we'll get to that a bit later.
You mentioned the Spanish Jesuits. You've mentioned them in other countries that you've spoken about too. How important was it to Spain and perhaps Portugal as well to bring Christianity to these countries?
Yes, well, this is a very interesting question, and I think it does quite glaringly expose the hypocrisy of the Spanish Empire, because at first, these Jesuit missions, and there were also Dominican missions as well, that were given authority to establish these, they were called misiones, the missions, but, you know, in some cases, they acted more like concentration camps where they essentially hemmed in indigenous people. Other times, these missions were some of the last resorts for safety for indigenous people, because the Jesuits and the Dominicans thought that at the end of the day, indigenous people were humans, contrary to what a lot of Spaniards were saying, contrary to what the conquistadors were saying. And of course, the conquistadors were the other major interest group or lobby group that was constantly petitioning the Spanish crown to reject the Jesuit demands for missions. Because of course, the conquistadors wanted that land and they wanted the Indians or the indigenous Americans as labor. The Jesuits and the Dominicans, of course, said, no, these are people. Of course, you know, in their own paternalistic way, they were saying, but they've, you know, they've strayed from God, they've strayed from Christianity, and we need to bring them back into the fold. This wasn't always received well by indigenous people, as I mentioned. Sometimes there were very, very spirited resistance against the missions and the Jesuits, and sometimes entire missions were destroyed by indigenous people. But on the other hand, as we began to see the Spanish genocide really taking full form, a lot of indigenous people willingly accepted entry into these missions because they knew that they wouldn't be killed by the conquistadors and by the Spanish army. From the one hand, it was a very sort of complicated process, and the Jesuits themselves had a very sort of interesting and complicated relationship with indigenous people. Some of them were very, very progressive and were very fierce defenders of the rights of indigenous people and even indigenous rights to land and sovereignty. But by and large, sadly, it was the conquistadors who had, of course, all of the money and all of the wealth from the New World that were more influential in the Spanish courts. And really, by the 1700s, the conquistadors had been able to essentially whittle down what support there was within the royal court for the Jesuits and for the missions. by the end of the 1700s, the 18th century, the Spanish had expelled most of the Jesuits from Latin America. So a lot of these missions were just left essentially to rot. Even to this day, you can go to countries like Paraguay, Uruguay, Bolivia, you will see the ruins of the Jesuit missions. In fact, I believe it's in Paraguay that one of these missions is a UNESCO World Heritage Site because it's been so well preserved, but it's overgrown by jungle, looks really quite mysterious and eerie. But that's what happened because, you know, the Spanish, of course, at the start used Christianity as an excuse. Of course, I think a lot of them believed it as well, that they were superior to the indigenous, to send out the Jesuits. But then, of course, once the conquistadors and the hard, cold money began entering the court, they were very, very compliant with the conquistadors' demands and were, as soon as they had welcomed the Jesuits and welcomed the Jesuit missions as a part of the Spanish imperial policy, they very quickly turned on them when that got in the way of money and land and the acquisition of more resources and slaves. This is what happened in Uruguay. This is what happened in Paraguay, Bolivia, in northern Argentina. This sort of like heart, this very, very unexplored heart of Latin America. But of course, it wasn't just the Spanish who were interested in Uruguay. There were other imperial powers, namely the English, who actually engaged in numerous wars against the Spanish, which we've spoken about because the English, of course, were Protestants and they were, you know, fiercely opposed to the Catholics. And they fought many, many wars against the French, against the Spanish, the Austrians in Europe itself, who were Catholic powers. And this extended to the colonies of those countries that did have colonies. And Spain, of course, was always a target for the British. At first, it started in the Caribbean, you know, with the financing of the privateers and the pirates, then spread to parts of Central America, Belize, the Mosquito Coast in Nicaragua, which was taken by the British. And then, of course, most interesting for the British, most sort of alluring, was the promise of the wealth that Buenos Aires had, that Argentina held, which, of course, did have at the time as well, vast mineral deposits. Buenos Aires was one of the wealthiest cities in the world in the 18th and 19th centuries. British, at first, as a stepping stone to conquer Buenos Aires, they launched a siege of Montevideo in 1807. This was a very, very brutal siege, and it lasted about 6 years. After the siege, there was occupation by about 12,000 British soldiers, and they essentially used La Banda Oriental and the city of Montevideo as a supplying ground, as a stationing point, to then lay siege to Buenos Aires, which they did. They did launch a siege of Buenos Aires not long after. But of course, there was a bit of a stalemate, you know, militarily speaking. The British couldn't quite dislodge the Spanish from Buenos Aires. Ultimately, by 1808, they agreed to a ceasefire and to a cessation of the hostilities, Spain and Britain, because Napoleon had just taken control of France in Europe. Napoleon had now espoused his vision for an imperial France across the entirety of Europe. Of course, saw Britain as its main adversary, but that also had countries like Spain that vacillated between the two sides in the crosshairs. And as we know, Napoleon invaded Spain at this time in 1807, 1808. And so the British and the Spanish put their differences aside. As soon as the war started, the war ended, the British withdrew from Montevideo, and these two countries began to fight side by side against Napoleon. This shows, you know, the very sort of destructive and punitive nature of imperialism in Latin America at the time, that they besieged Montevideo, razed large parts of the city to the ground. And then, you know, as soon as it was convenient, the Spanish and the British agreed to a ceasefire, and then they went off to fight together against the French. As we've mentioned before as well, it was this Napoleonic War that sort of really gave an impetus to a lot of the revolutionary movements in Latin America. You know, these people like Simón Bolívar. And then, of course, down in Argentina, we had San Agustín, who was essentially the southern cone version of Simón Bolívar. It's important to remember that Bolívar was up in the north of South America, in Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, Peru. But in the south, there was a sort of a separate campaign against the Spanish. And this was led by San Agustín from Argentina, from Buenos Aires, who was essentially, yeah, the Argentinian version of Bolívar. They were in communication with each other. These two great liberator figures did give each other logistical support, supply support, but it was really a sort of separate engagement when we're talking about Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay. And ultimately, you know, we saw the emergence of these two sides when we're looking at these independence wars. We saw the revolutionaries who wanted independence for Latin America and for the Latin American countries. And then we saw the royalists. So those local Criollo elite, sort of Spanish-blooded but born in Latin America group, whom were more favorable towards the Spanish crown and wanted to keep Spanish control of these territories. And this trickled down to Uruguay, where we saw this battle between the revolutionaries on the one hand and the royalists on the other. And this was tied very intimately to the same battle going on in Buenos Aires. So this is what I was saying, you know, when we talk about Uruguay, it's often tied to these larger countries around it. You know, what happens in Argentina or Brazil will often very, very strongly influence history in Uruguay itself. And the man who comes to lead the revolutionaries, so the independence fighters in Uruguay, is José Gervasio Artigas. Now, he was a very poor man, enlisted in the army and worked his way up, as many of these figures did. And he is widely regarded as the national hero of Uruguay. Even though he would never actually preside over a country called Uruguay itself, he laid the groundwork for the creation of the Republic of Uruguay. And he was a very, very esteemed commander. He was a very, very smart, intelligent strategist. Very, very quickly, he routed the royalists in Uruguay. This war lasted from about 1810 to 1813, only 3 years. In other parts of Latin America, these wars would last up to a decade, if not longer. But Artigas was a very popular, charismatic individual. He drew a lot of Uruguayans to his banner, and also people from neighboring Brazil and Argentina. And of course, he had the support of the Argentinian revolutionaries as well, which was very, very important at this time. And ultimately, by 1815, so the hostilities had ended by 1813, but negotiations were ongoing over territory and what was going to constitute future country in Banda Oriental. And in 1815, Artigas created the League of Free Peoples, La Liga de los Pueblos Libres, which was a very, very emancipatory project. It encompassed all of modern-day Uruguay, parts of southern Brazil, and parts of Argentina as well. Essentially, it was based on a centralized secular state led by Artigas. The defining policy and ultimately what would be the undoing of the League of Free Peoples was a widespread and the first of its kind in Latin America land reform. And this is critical. This is the first nationwide land reform that took place in Latin America to empower small farmers, small shareholders. And critically, they included former slaves and they included indigenous people as equal claimants to land in this reform process. Now, this is really, really important because it's the first time a Latin American country took such revolutionary and drastic measures to essentially address, you know, those centuries of colonial abuse and exploitation. So Artigas was a visionary leader. You know, I do consider him to be in the same league as Simón Bolívar. Unfortunately, a policy like this, a land reform that was ongoing and successful at the time, was naturally going to threaten some of those other nations around Uruguay or around the League of Free Peoples at this point that were threatened by the emancipation of the slaves and indigenous people and land reform, of course, for small farmers that went against the interests of the landed elite of the latifundistas, you know, those big landlords. And so what happened was the Portuguese in Brazil saw this happening and they were frightened. This put the fear of God into the Portuguese regime in Brazil because, of course, Brazil was entirely dependent on a slave economy, on a slave plantation economic system. And when they saw just at their southern border, the League of Free Peoples emancipating these people, not only that, but giving them land, the Portuguese became extremely hostile to the League of Free Peoples. And just a year after it was created, 1816, the Portuguese invaded the League of Free Peoples. The Portuguese counted on the manpower of the Brazilian population, of a number of Portuguese settlers who had come over, and they were able to completely overwhelm the League of Free Peoples and its very small army. And at this time, the Argentinians were still fighting for their independence. They couldn't lend the necessary assistance to the League of Free Peoples, and there were some people in Argentina, of course, who didn't want to either, who had their own interests, you know, in creating a more sort of capitalistic, monopolistic model in Argentina. So that was unresolved at the time. And the Portuguese conquered the League of Free Peoples and annexed it and created essentially a new state, a new province of Brazil, which was called Cisplatina. they essentially reinstated slavery. They abolished the land reform program. Artigas was thrown into exile, died shortly afterwards. And it was a Brazilian colony or a new Brazilian province really up until at about 1821, 1822. So not long after it had been incorporated into Brazil, we see 33 individuals launch a very spirited and some said reckless amphibious assault of the city of Cisplatina. These were called Los 33 Orientales, the 33 Easterners or from La Banda Oriental. And these were 33 essentially prodigies of Artigas. So 33 essentially students of Artigas, of the revolutionary generation, led by Antonio Lavallejas, who was very, very close to Artigas in the years of the independence wars. And they claimed this city with a band of soldiers, of exiles, declared the secession of Cisplatina from Brazil. They said, we are reclaiming what was once the League of Free Peoples, and this is now under control of the 33 revolutionaries. They created a revolutionary military junta. And of course, at this time, Brazil was now independent. By the early 1820s, Brazil had essentially transitioned from Portuguese royal rule to Brazilian royal rule, keeping in mind that the Brazilian royal family was an offshoot of the Portuguese royal line. And the Brazilians launched an invasion of the newly declared Republic of Cisplatina. And we saw another war between Brazil and between this fledgling Uruguayan, or this country that was eventually going to become Uruguay.
And you've been listening to part one of the country profile of Uruguay in South America. And next week, part two with Sasha Gillies-Lacakis.
The Melbourne Documentary Film Festival returns to Cinema Nova this July for Past, Present, Future. Beginning on July 15, warm up the cold winter days with a revitalising collection of local and international documentaries from independent and emerging talents. Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, a jewel in Melbourne's cultural crown. Screening from July the 15th for a limited time at Cinema Nova, 380 Lygon Street, Carlton. Cinema Nova is a 3CR supporter.
I'm speaking now with Professor Emeritus Stuart Rees. Stuart, a great victory for Antoinette Latouf, but it has much wider implications.
Thank you for that question about Antoinette Latouf and the findings of the court that her dismissal was wrong, illegal. A basic principle about free speech, but in this case it was about the slaughter of the Palestinians. How on earth a public media such as the ABC could not tolerate criticism of Israel? That's the question which she really challenged by her courage. It takes a lot of stamina and courage, as well as quite a few other resources, to persist with the kind of legal challenge that she engaged in. And we are all the beneficiaries of the fact that she won, that the court ruled in her favor. And it's a lesson for people in authority to learn, not just people running the ABC, but people in politics, people in universities, people in the churches who've been amazingly silent on these issues.
But the implications for the Zionist movement?
They should be sent into purgatory. They should be sent to Coventry. We shouldn't be hearing from them again. Well, they've been trying to dominate the narrative for 77 years. The poisonous effect of letters from powerful lawyers threatening legal action if somebody dares to say something that has the slightest hint of anti-Semitism about it, alleged anti-Semitism, that really has to stop. You're quite right. They've received a number of defeats in the false claims they make about anti-Semitism and racism. They are false, but they never cease to make them. I read the transcript of a member of the Zionist Federation who gave evidence to the New South Wales State's inquiry into anti-Semitism. I mean, the guy was trying to insist that ethnic cleansing didn't exist in Palestine. He was allowed to carry on and on with this false narrative. So although they've been defeated, there's no evidence that they're going away.
And the fact that anti-Semitism equates to racism, yet no other group in society get the attention.
Because it's the Zionist group who want, you know, who are not really very old historically. I mean, Judaism is thousands and thousands of years old, my understanding is. And Zionism is a relatively recent invention. It's about land grab. It's about stealing. It's about ethnic cleansing. It's about colonization. And the frightened politicians in Western governments, not just Australia's, can't see that. That's the problem. Of course, the media bolsters it. The vice chancellors in the universities, not all of them, seem to be frightened. There's an issue here, Jan, which is missing, which is what I would call courage in public life. We need to talk a bit about the courage of Latouf, the courage of Ed Husic, the courage of the cricketer Khawaja, as combating the Zionist lobby.
We shouldn't have to, should we?
No, we shouldn't. No. So that's a good question. Why are we having to spend time on this? The amount of effort that's been put into inquiries into anti-Semitism is an entire deflection away from the need to send a naval escort to protect humanitarian aid boats to the shores of Gaza. The politicians, the media, the human rights activists like myself and yourself and others should be howling for the world's navies, at least the Western government's navies, to intervene to protect, to provide supplies. But instead, we're supposed to pay attention to anti-Semitism.
And when you look at the impact of the war between Russia and Ukraine and the efforts of not only Australia but the whole Western world to rush arms in, rush money in, do all they can, yet sure, Palestinians sure they just don't seem to exist for those governments.
Sure. I mean, the hypocrisy is terrible. Sanctions immediately by all the Western governments on Russia over its brutal invasion of Ukraine, fine. But nothing about Israel. Nothing at all. It's a cancer. It's a cancer in our midst. The cancer is the primary site of the cancer is the decades and decades of allowing Israel to be above the law, allowing Israel to be never held accountable, allowed to act with impunity. That cancer has got to be removed.
I'm not sure whether you would have spoken to your friend Mary Kostakidis since this announcement last week, but she must be feeling buoyed at the moment, although her case is a little bit different, but it's still Zionists.
Sure. Oh, yes, it's Mr. Mark Liebler and his massive law firm in Melbourne. The guy loves litigation. I won't say on radio what I think of the threatening letters that he sends to people, but when will the bullying stop? If I see a bully in the home or on the streets or in international relations, I say to them, I'm sorry, you can't behave like that. It's not just the principles of human rights and international law that tell us that, but it's something called a common decency. But people like Liebler and co. don't seem to understand that. They seem to think they have a prerogative of self-importance to be able to influence politicians, the media, universities. And again, that's part of what I will call the cancer in our midst that has to be removed. We've buried our heads in the sand for decades. It's easy to document the number of slaughters of Palestinian people that far outnumber anything that Hamas did in October 2023. And yet the media behaves as though international terrorism only started in October 23 and it's all about Hamas. One of the intellectual political responsibilities is to demystify what is understood by Hamas. The Israelis and the Americans are justifying the slaughter of hundreds of people every week or more by saying it's all about Hamas. And yet in the same breath, they claim to have virtually exterminated Hamas. And the Israelis have had thousands of Hamas incidents, which they crafted themselves, quite apart from the terrible irony that Hamas stayed alive because it was funded by Israel.
Look at the Australian involvement, the fact that Australia has done next to nothing to put our concerns on the world stage. But the other issue is the number of Australians who are actually serving with the IDF in Gaza. It's estimated that could be over 1,000 Australians there. When you look at the war crimes that have been committed, that means that those Australians could be liable to war crimes.
Absolutely.
Freedom of information to the government gets nowhere.
No. Well, I mean, thousands of, probably over 1,000 Australians who've been brainwashed with the Israel right or wrong all the way for most of their lives at home or in schools or in other institutions. I've seen estimates that as many as 124,000 American young men are fighting in Israel alongside the IDF. It's very difficult to be sure of that information, but again, they're not held accountable. It's very difficult to make the information clear, but it's as though the slaughter of Palestinians gives them entitlement to carry on without being hindered in any way.
And the number of Australian small businesses that are involved in making parts for the, well, we don't know where they're going to, but we assume that they're going to Israel via America.
It's obvious that people involved in arms manufacture around the world are making a fortune out of the Israeli slaughter in Gaza. Certainly the Americans are. You can't supply billions of dollars worth of arms without various major arms manufacturers making a fortune. Australia is happy to join that. We're desperate to be the 10th most successful arms exporter in the world. There's no doubt that at least indirectly, perhaps using America as an agent, we've been helping the Israeli onslaught. Even dare we mention the use of Pine Gap. The Pine Gap listening station, which is really an American base on Australian soil, enables the precision bombing of targets in Gaza, or a supposed precision bombing. We are up to our necks in it, but it takes a lot of courage. It takes some courage to stop that policy.
Well, it's the people of the world who have got the courage. It's the governments who haven't.
You're dead right. There's a mismatch between what the public want and feel now and how the people in Canberra, London, Paris, Berlin behave. It happened, of course, over the invasion of Iraq in 2003. There was an almighty mismatch between what Blair and Bush wanted and decided, how the public felt.
You've been speaking with your Palestinian friends over the last week or so, Stuart. It must be absolutely appalling for them, with their friends and families being obliterated in Palestine.
There's a massive mental health problem for many of us, but particularly for Palestinians. I mean, my Palestinian friends have been in Sydney, have been seeking help from the Prime Minister to return to Gaza to look for their members of their family somewhere buried under a pile of rubble. This is the most horrendous, cruelest atrocity we've had to witness since the Second World War. But it is allowed to go on. The Palestinians, half of their families are destroyed, or most of them have disappeared. I doubt there's hardly a Palestinian who doesn't know of family members who've been killed, tens of thousands of them. And we're all supposed to, you know, say that the issue is the cost of living, the real issue is the cost of living in Australia.
We had hoped that maybe the re-election of the Labor Party might have spurred them along to do something, but not so.
I mean, there are going to be various efforts in the first and second weeks of the new sitting in July.
Yes.
There's going to be an invasion of buses in the first week. And together with my colleagues in Australians for Humanity will be taking a delegation to the parliament to meet with, mostly with newly elected members, to say, well, what is your stand on this major human rights, major humanitarian issue of your time? The trouble is that the 60 plus new backbenchers will be spending most of their time trying to discover where the toilets are and who their new secretaries are, trying to make Gaza a major issue in all the constituencies is an uphill climb.
We've all got to pull our weight.
Absolutely, absolutely. No. I agree with that. We have to do more and more. How we are expected to tolerate the announcement, the glib announcement by the media every morning that another 50 people have been killed, then we get some Israeli spokesperson with a holier-than-thou appearance explaining that it was all the fault of Hamas. The lying, the terrible lying that the Israelis go in for, that's got to be exposed and resisted.
Well, thank you for today, Stuart, and we will talk again.
Okay, Jan, thanks so much. Yeah, bye-bye.
And I've been speaking with Professor Emeritus Stuart Rees.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
Speaking now with Wayne Wadsworth and his project Worldwise, Eco Banking Systems and Commonwealth Banks. Empowering people to design and build renewable economy projects and places. But first, Wayne, to let people know who you are and where you come from, what you've been involved in the latest years and how this has influenced your latest plan.
Just about on the big 70 this year, and I've had a lifetime of politics since my early 20s. I came into politics through being opposed to the South African racist tour of New Zealand in the early 70s. So I got into politics then and came to Australia and got involved in Melbourne politics quite heavily and 3CR and all that sort of stuff. Probably a bit later the Greens, and then very much into environmental sort of politics really. So very quick life's journey.
And your new project?
Trying to set up a desert thing in a little country town called Iron Knob in South Australia. That's been going okay, but my sort of latest project is looking at how we look at sort of new banking systems and create peace, love and jelly beans. I'm not sure or not, but the problem we face, you know, particularly in the left, is that we haven't been able to progress probably since the collapse of the Soviet Union. We've gone, I think, backward, and we haven't really able to put together a new vision for humanity. I think we're stuck on the old one, and while it has its merits, it hasn't really taken us forward.
Well, there's a huge amount of thinking and research behind this project. You've been delving into recent history for an understanding of where we stand today. So when was your starting point for your research?
Well, I think you've really got to go back to the banking system itself and the creation of the banking system, you know, because let's face it, you got no money, you got no honey, have you? But my thing is that no bucks, no wars. No bucks, no bombs, no wars. If there's no bucks for the bombs, there's no bombs, is there? Who finances wars? Who makes profit from it? Small group of bankers, really. Sort of going back into that history. You know, it's a funny thing, you know, when you go to school, you don't learn about how banks work, or you don't even learn about money, really, which is a strange thing because we can't really live without it, can we? In today's modern world, you could try, but you wouldn't last long. I sort of delved back into the history of banking and as it evolved historically and what role the banks played, and particularly in war, financing industry, and what industries those financed and which ones they held back and didn't finance. So that's been an interesting journey.
Can you give us some examples of what you've discovered, or what we all should discover, but we haven't bothered to look?
No, well, that's true. We haven't bothered to look, have we? I think following the sort of Rothschilds were, I suppose, the first war bankers, not the first war bankers, but certainly ones that profited from investing in the French wars, where they invested, they thought that the Battle of Waterloo, many of their stock market thought that they'd lost the battle and sold their shares, and the Rothschilds knew that they'd won it before anybody else and bought all the shares at a very low price. And when they realised that they'd won the war, obviously the stock prices went rocketed and the Rothschilds made a lot of money. In terms of, I suppose, crude sort of making money from war and misery, the Rothschilds were probably the first ones of very noticeable size, but certainly not just akin to the Rothschilds. It's interesting because, if you look at the British Empire, for example, the old British pound sterling, and you had to have sterling pretty much anywhere in the empire to trade with. So it was a trading system. Well, the Dutch actually set up a trading system, obviously the Dutch East Indies Company, which traded in guilder, but really the British Empire was probably the first empire to have such a huge network of banking elites. And obviously the Rothschilds were very much involved with that. So there's other banks, not just the Rothschilds, but the Rothschilds represented a family in that they had the actual family running banks in Germany and France and the Netherlands and England, and they were pretty much global bankers, and I think they were involved in American banking as well in its early days, and still are to this day, obviously. So that sort of whole banking system, and it was very much a private banking system in its early days, but the government, I think in England in the 1940s, nationalised the Bank of England under government control. But so that's sort of the history of it. But it was interesting at the end of the Second World War that England had to hand over its empire to the United States, particularly its financial empire, and we went from having pound sterling as the global trading currency to the American dollar. And I think that's where the dollar now is totally weaponized. They can put boycotts on countries and stop them from trading, and you have to have American dollars to trade, and if you don't do as you're told, they'll put sanctions on you. And so the dollar's been probably weaponised more than it's ever been weaponised, even under the English.
And the war was connected to that?
Which wars weren't connected to it?
United States wars, I'm thinking about. Yeah, they financed them all.
Exactly. Well, the Vietnam War was where they really started coming undone. I mean, the Korean War, they probably made a lot of money from it, but the Vietnamese wars, when actually United States went and became a debtor country. So before that, everyone owed United States money via the dollar or gold. What happened in the Bretton Woods Agreement at the end of the Second World War is they established gold at $35 an ounce, and you had to have $35 of American dollars to buy an ounce of gold. That lasted up until 1972, I think it was, when they'd gone very much into debt to finance the war, and that was a sort of a government-private debt. The French actually sent a battleship to the United States and said, look, we want our gold back, basically, here's your currency. I think they actually forced to get them, but very soon after that, Nixon withdrew the gold backing from the dollar because they didn't have actually enough dollars at $35 an ounce if all the countries that had their dollars cashed them in. So that was really the start of the crisis. And I remember that period. We all remember Vietnam. We were always thinking, oh, goody, this is the end of America. And socialist utopia is on its way, which never eventuated, unfortunately. We're still stuck with the American system today, and it's probably worse than it was when Nixon withdrew the dollar from the gold.
But it's got a big challenge now.
The fascinating thing is we all thought it was going to collapse. I mean, I can remember in those days, even then, sort of going around with left-wing newspapers proclaiming the end of America. They were very very smart, and they got petrodollars. They basically got the Middle Eastern countries to agree to only trade oil in the US dollars in return that they would make sure they didn't get overthrown, particularly Saudi Arabia. They basically said, you know, you can have all the gold, all the oil in the country amongst the royal family, who were just a bunch of parasites, really, guaranteed them that they wouldn't get a, you know, no one could overthrow them. If they tried, the American would intervene, as long as they traded in all the oil in dollars. So that was sort of stabilised the dollar and allowed them to print unlimited amounts of the currency, and also to threaten countries if they didn't behave themselves, they'd get the oil cut off. The petrodollar was actually almost as powerful as gold, really. When you think of gold, it doesn't really do anything practical except for making jewellery, but oil you can't really do without, can you?
All along comes BRICS.
Well, BRICS is interesting because it really led from that countries, particularly after they overthrew Gaddafi, because Gaddafi was going to set up an African currency backed by gold, because he had a hell of a lot of gold and he had oil. So the Europeans and the Americans through NATO made up an excuse that this guy's a terrible dictator and we have to get rid of him, bomb the crap out of the country, and then helped ISIS into the country. And if you look at what the United States has done through the Middle East, everyone goes, oh, America wants to win wars. They don't. They're not interested in winning wars, because if they won in Iraq, you know, you broke it, you own it. What they're interested in is really just smashing the countries apart and extracting their oil and leaving the countries, basically when they leave, in total disarray, which they've done in every country they've been in. In Iraq, firstly, Iraq's still a mess. Libya's still a mess. Afghanistan's still a mess. Syria's a hell of a mess. So all those four countries, they're still a mess. And this is a plan that actually goes back many years and was very much involved the Zionists, in terms of the Israelis wanted these countries all dismantled, basically, for their own, you know, their own expansion desires. A huge distrust amongst all the Arabs, even the Arab countries that are puppets to the United States, that can't really trust them. Because Saddam Hussein was just an American puppet. He was only threatening because he got pissed off that the Americans told him to go into another country and then they kicked his ass. He was working for the CIA well before they put him in place. The Shah of Iran was CIA, you know. So these were puppet regimes installed by the Americans, basically. Interesting enough, the very interesting thing about BRICS is that it was pretty much set up mainly by China and Russia, mainly by the Russians because of the sanctions put on them. The Arab countries actually involved in, some of them are members, so which hasn't made the Americans at all happy. You know, sort of where we're at the moment is the Americans know if they lose the hegemony of the American dollar that there's nothing much left because they've got a huge, an enormous deficit. The interesting thing about it, you know, the sort of contradictions of China exist, that Americans really live off Chinese credit. Chinese buy American debt, trillions of dollars worth of it, so they can buy Chinese products. So the banking system becomes so mad and contradictory, it really doesn't make any sense at all. You know, when the British ran the old British Empire, you had to certainly have pounds and sterlings to trade, but the British always obviously kept it a surplus, so they were the king, you know, and get a hell of a lot of gold. They had financial backing, but the Americans, the only thing that's backing the American dollar at the moment is oil. And if they lose control of oil and that trade and the hegemony of the American dollar, then they know that, you know, if people say, oh, look, Trump's crazy, he wants to keep the dollar. Trump understands that if they lose the dollar, America's really in trouble.
Well, along comes Wayne Wadsworth with his project to replace and democratise the central banking system with worldwide bank systems, WEB. Mm. Yep. How will that work?
If we think of the banking system at the moment, it's ran through International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is sort of a bully boy bankers go around countries and give out loans, particularly in Africa, and charge them interest rates, which they can't really afford to pay back. And then when they're bankrupt, they set private companies in to take over their assets. So they privatise, and we've done it in Australia as well, privatise their electrical system, their school system, railways, health. Everything gets privatised and put into private hands. And usually sort of, you know, well, they pick over the bones till there's nothing much left. So Africa's particularly suffered because they've been very difficult for them to rise up. They've been kept as a raw material supplier. So you've got the IMF, which is the main role there. You've got the World Bank, which plays a similar role, but what people don't know about is the Bank of International Settlement. It's a very sort of secretive organisation, and they do settlements between countries. So, you know, you want to buy some oil from Saudi Arabia, you buy dollars, pay that to whoever you're paying that to, and it gets transferred, recycled all through the dollars. I've done a lot of research. A lot of it's not public knowledge. So I think we need a system that's really open, that every country has some say in it. At the moment, really, the United States, Britain and France run the international banking system, and really, push comes to shove, the Americans make the final decision. So you've got a small, very tiny group of bankers that are running the international trade system, which is highly secretive, that no one knows really how it works or who's running it. If you get out of line, they basically kick your butt. So I think we need a banking system where every country has a say. You know, like if every country in the world had represented on a board, they voted on policy, and well, it's a thing that would be far more democratic than one country running the whole thing.
How would you get it off the ground?
We have to start a sort of network of people discussing these ideas, you know, like how would it all go together. I've done a broad outline of it, but it needs people who work in those fields to network together. You know, I've obviously got a network now where people can network quite easily together. If we start a global network of people promoting these ideas and discussing it and saying how it could work and all that sort of thing, makes a starting point for it. And that's sort of where I'm at the moment, is trying to work out how we network with other people, like-minded people around the world. And there sort of does exist a very loose network of people talking about it. I mean, there's some good economists. The guy in Europe, I can't think of his name at the moment, who wrote the book on feudalism, eco-feudalism. I can't think of his name at the moment. But anyway, the guy that was running, the Minister for Finance in Greece when they overthrew the socialist government there, he's written quite a few books. He's certainly out there, and they've sort of got quite a global movement happening on that front. There's some quite good American economists, mostly on the left, on the same level, but it really hasn't opened up to sort of common folk like us, you know, who aren't really in that club. You know, we need to sort of get that information at a lower level where you have a lot more people involved in that discussion of it. So I think if we could establish a group of people working on that idea of having a worldwide bank that actually serves the people, not just the banksters, as I call them, that would be a really positive thing. And I think, well, at the moment, the most important thing is to, you know, this idea of no bucks, no bombs, no wars, because if there's no finance for armies, well, you can't have armies, can you? If no one's financing nuclear bombs and bombs to drop on people, then they're not going to get dropped on people. You know, we tend to start at the other end. We go, oh, let's stop the war. Well, how does a war start? Well, it starts because someone's financing it. So if there's no money for them, it's not going to happen. I mean, you know, we're all talking now about increasing our so-called defence budget. And I love how they call it a defence budget. I mean, it's such a misnomer, isn't it? It's a bloody war budget. Australia's a part of that war budget. Whenever Americans go into war, we're jumping in behind them.
Well, what's your currency going to look like?
What you have to do, you obviously have to have a global currency, because you can't, you know, at the moment our global currency is the dollar. About 90% of the world trade happens in dollars, you know. So you do have to have a currency, but it shouldn't belong to one country. It would probably be a dollar, certainly not an American dollar, but it would probably just be a global dollar, you know, or a worldwide dollar. And that way you can use a lot of the infrastructure that already exists. It's not necessarily that you have to replace the infrastructure that's already in place in terms of the technology for trading, because that technology already exists. It's just under the control of the wrong people, that's all. If you had a worldwide banking system where every country was part of that, I mean, it was sort of in some ways operate a little bit like a parliament in terms of, obviously there's a certain amount of trade happening in the world. The surplus from that, you know, like an African country could say, look, we need $100 billion to put a railway line from the top of Africa to the bottom of Africa, and that would be the sort of things they could finance.
You're going to have a lot of opposition to that, though. I can think of all the multinational corporations floating around the world making absolute billions of dollars just by the flick of a switch. How would you manage that?
Well, that's where you need that whole public thing happening, isn't it? You know, where you've got millions of people saying this is the change we want. There's no way that could happen through parliamentary to parliamentary sort of negotiations. So actually, you have to build a worldwide movement where you can start building that pressure. And also those networks, because then those networks become obviously people who are involved in the banking system who could actually put together organisations to build that. So it really is a grassroots thing. It's not something you go to the IMF and say, look, you guys, how about you democratise yourself? Couldn't imagine that, could you? And it's quite contradictory, because if you think of the Chinese central bank, it actually is a publicly owned bank. But the central bank in America, my understanding, is actually still a private bank. I mean, it has a lot of influence from the government, but in all essence, it's a private bank. Bank of England, I'm not sure about that. It's pretty hard to find out whether it's actually publicly owned or privately owned. But most central banks either are run by the government, and the people that run them are actually from private banks. So, you know, there's huge conflicts of interest there. If you've got a private bank and you're the head of the central bank, you've got a huge contradiction of interest. You know, that core of building a network of people around the world is primary to that change, and that, you know, that can happen quite quickly. You know, it could be a year or two before you had that core numbers. But you sort of probably need 100,000-odd people around the world that can organise that sort of transformation. The Varoufakis.
Yeah. Can you talk more about his ideas and what you've got from him?
He's a very fascinating guy, because he's, as I say, he's written quite a few books, and I think the last one was on pseudo-capitalism. So he maintains that capitalism doesn't actually exist anymore, because it's been overtaken by big tech companies through the what they call cloud rental. So, for example, big internet companies who sell things get rent money. They don't manufacture the product. They just use their website to sell things, and they get exorbitant amounts of money and make exorbitant amount of money. And they're pretty much a monopoly. There's only three or four big companies that are doing it. You've got that. And he maintains that, you know, we should be sort of having a rental, like they should be paying taxes on that. You know, most of them pay little to no taxes. And that we should be taxing those systems to democratise them, and where workers could buy into those companies. Don't disagree with him, but my problem with that is that because technology is changing so fast, on 20 years' time, those companies that maybe employ a million people now will probably only employ 100,000 because of robotics and AI. I'm not sure in the long term that would work. I mean, it could work as a sort of transitional thing, but my thing is that once people really essentially own the banking system, taxes and things on the banking side, transfer, you know, like when you buy something, you pay a tax on it rather than an income tax, because people won't really have income because they won't have a job. And a lot of money could be raised for that, you know, for community use and social use and things like that. So I think we're at a very crossroads of humanity, where you'll either have a very tiny minority of bankers and techno feudal lords, landlords, who will own and control everything, and the rest of us will be sort of peasants on social welfare, enough possibly survive, but not much more. So unless we sort of run the financial system, we're pretty much doomed to be feudal peasants, really. Feudal techno peasants, as Varoufakis says. But I think that's the other part of my equation, was that we need a new global banking system, but we also need a localised banking system, you know, where you've got banks which actually create community wealth, and that wealth's actually kept in the community. And it's the other part of the equation, because you've really got to have a system that keeps wealth in the community rather than shipped off to, you know, some central bank somewhere. That's a really important thing, because, you know, look, if you think what sort of jobs we're going to have. Well, we're going to have probably jobs in tourism. I could see that obviously being quite a big employer. But really jobs are going to be in education and arts and all those human things that don't require manufacturing things. You know, manufacturing will be done either on a 3D printer at home, or bigger things will be made with very little human labour.
Well, you're thinking of a system which defunds war. What can you do about the ecosystem which is under such dire stress at the moment? How would that fit in with your plan?
Well, that actually is an easy one, isn't it? Because when you liberate capital, you can then direct some of that capital to earth repair systems. You know, when you think of it, if you're living in, let's say, I don't know, Northcote, your social welfare says, well, as part of your payment, you need to plant some trees and make your environment better. And 10 hours a week, part of that payment will be for you to go out and do whatever good things in the community can do, whether planting trees or community gardens or, you know, looking after old people or whatever. It sort of liberates human labour to a huge extent. China is actually quite a good example. If you're seeing the money they've invested in making cities and in the environment, I mean, they're electric cars, wind power, solar power. China's by far the biggest country greening the desert. They're hundreds of thousands of acres a year of greening the desert. So, you know, all that labour they had that were doing the physical labour before at very low technology level, now they've got very high technology. A lot of those jobs have disappeared, but they've put it into repairing the country. I don't see the evolution of technology as an elimination of jobs as a bad thing. It's just we can then use that wealth that's produced by those technologies to, you know, repair the place. There's plenty to repair.
And where's your going to be your new source of energy for your new societies?
Oh my golly, that's the big thing, isn't it? None of us are getting any younger. Hopefully the younger people, you know, realistically, they're going to have to step up. But I think they've been obviously kept in debt and kept in ignorance. If you look at universities these days, they're pretty appalling, really. You know, they've become sort of factory fodder for turnout people for jobs that aren't going to exist anyway. But if you look back, you know, during the Vietnam War and those periods when universities were very active, they were places of an explosion in social thought, and that really has to return. You know, education systems have to be allowed to be a lot more creative, and that's where your young people come in. Because I think if you give them the tools to be creative, they will be. If you give them the tools to be in debt when they leave school or leave university, and with a great big $100,000 debt, in most cases, not really well-paid jobs, incredibly how expensive rental and housing markets, then you wind up with a bit of a dysfunctional young people, really. I mean, when I left school, it was not that hard to buy a house. You know, you could save a deposit in a year or two. Your mortgage was about 25 or 30% of your one person's income. Now it's about 40 or 50% of two people's income. So people don't have children. I mean, that's the other problem. We've actually got a declining birth rate. If we didn't have immigration in Australia, we'd be losing population quite rapidly. Japan and China are in huge crisis in terms of their rapidly aging population.
Well, finally, Wadsey, in a climate where there's a lot of despair, you're the optimist.
Oh, you have to be an optimist, don't you? Otherwise, you'd be a pessimist. We all get pretty pessimistic. I mean, if look at what's happening in the world just the last 2 weeks. Poor old Iranians have been rained bombs on top of their heads for what reason? Because they stuck up against Israel and said, you can't butcher people and starve them to death like the Nazis did to you. But it's, you know, it's pretty depressing. You know, I mean, I think that's probably what drove me to thinking, well, how the hell do you actually stop this? You know, what's the driving force behind it? Where's the root cause? So unless you go back to the root cause, which obviously is banking and financing wars, then it is pretty depressing, really. How else could you stop it? We could, all the young people rise up all around the world and go blah, blah, blah. And they have, if you remember when they rose up against Wall Street, you know, the Wall Street thing quite a few years ago, there was hundreds of thousands parked outside Wall Street going, you know, justice just never really went anywhere, just fade into obscurity. So, you know, that's really where you need to look at the core problems and then bring people together with demands, with ideas of
building alternatives. The left has really failed on it.
If people want to share their resources and their ideas with you, how do they do that?
They can contact me just on my email at wadsyouwell@gmail.com. At the moment, I'm just in the process of setting up a website and a podcast. So I'm hoping to get that podcast sort of happening, well, before the end of this year or early next year.
All right. Well, thank you for all that. And
no worries,
Ben. Set people thinking.
Hopefully.
I've been speaking with Wayne Wadsworth, and you would like to contact Wayne. It's wadzywell@gmail.com.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.